The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast. Before a live audience at the Beer Baron in Washington following the NatSec Girl Squad conference, about which we will hear more in a little while.
We can clap for that.
The National Security Girl Squad had its first conference today, and we're going to talk about that momentarily. But with me first is my Brookings colleague, Jung Pak, who has some extraordinary expertise on matters currently in the news that I thought would be a great subject for a conversation here tonight. Jung is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in our foreign policy program, and she is a longtime North Korea CIA analyst. And so let's start, Jung, with that New York Times story the other day. That suggested that North Korea hadn't been entirely straightforward about its missile development.
Thanks, Ben, and thanks to the NatSec Girl Squad for inviting me to join you today. This is super exciting for me. So on the New York Times article based on the Center for Strategic and International Studies study, based on commercial imagery of North Korea, they found 16 or so, or 13 something or other, missile bases in North Korea. So when that story broke, I didn't really pay that much attention to it because it's North Korea has missile bases. That's what they do. But I think what happened was that because the Times and couch it in terms of North Korea's deception, it made people pay attention to it more. I think what the biggest takeaway from that article is that North Korea has missile bases, and that the North Korean threat has metastasized to an extent where we can't just be talking about a few missiles here and there, but we're talking about ICBMs, shorter range ballistic missiles. And the fact that even though they're not testing ballistic missiles right now or doing nuclear tests, that they continue to develop their weapons program.
So to me, the big takeaway was less about North Korea than about the president, right? Because, you know, like, if you told me, okay, North Korea, whatever they say in public, there are missile bases, I would have said, duh, right? But the fact that the administration has had ginned up this idea that we were kind of reaching a different point in which maybe there would be transparency and non-deception. This seemed like suddenly a big deal, less because of what it said about North Korea and more because of what it said about our expectations of them.
Right. And it's not just President Trump who's been raising expectations about North Korea and how much has been accomplished or not accomplished with North Korea, but it's also the South Korean President Moon who's been talking up how Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, is sincere. He's really made a strategic decision, and that we need to keep moving forward and even lifting sanctions, as the South Korean president would argue, and as Kim Jong-un would argue. But in fact, we find out that, as these reports are trickle out, that it really lays bare and exposes the anemic nature of the Singapore summit from June that was between Kim Jong-un and President Trump, and the fact that that the reality is different from the political narrative that's being spun.
So I'm interested in the process of North Korea analysis. You know, it's one of these worlds that you are looking at this very complex tapestry on a wall in a room, and you're looking at it sort of through a keyhole with the lights off. And so what is the job of a CIA North Korea analyst, and how is it different from the job of a Brookings CIA analyst?
Brookings has no affiliation with the CIA, right, Ben?
Not to my knowledge.
Yeah, it's like looking through a keyhole or listening to a phone conversation. You only hear one part of it. Or it's like a reality show that you're watching, but the episodes are all scrambled up, and the characters keep changing, like fake Becky from, what was that show? The Connors, the prequel. But North Korea is like that, and you have to constantly figure out what your assumptions are, and how, if you change your assumptions, how the analysis might be different. And on North Korea, you know, I was not a North Korea person. I thought I was going to be a history PhD person and teach history at the university level and talk about social rights and civil rights movement. But I think on North Korea, you have to really keep an open mind about what is and what isn't, and be really humble about how horribly wrong that you can be. And so you couch your assessments and have a confidence level on a lot of things. So I think for North Korea, which is one of the hardest targets because of the lack of access that we have to the leadership, that it's really important to continue to check assumptions, talk to other people, get as much information as you can.
And when you, like, there are parts of the world where they're sufficiently vibrant targets in terms of what we're capable of collecting, that the difference between being inside the government and being outside the government, in terms of the quality of the information you're dealing with, is immense. And the thing that I always wonder about North Korea is how much more do the people with access to everything actually know that's analytically valuable than the people who are just reading the newspaper? Is this a situation where you get where there are actually really, really elucidating information streams? Or is this a situation where there's a lot of classified information and at the end of the day it basically boils down to, you know, what we could learn from the New York Times?
I think No matter who you ask or what country you cover or what kind of issue you cover, there's no way that you can get as much. There's no amount of information harder than leadership intentions, because that's getting into somebody's head. And no amount of resources or technology can get inside somebody's head. And so capabilities are much easier because those are observables, but it's the intentions that are always the sticking point when you're trying to give the right assessments or helpful or useful assessments or actionable assessments to the president and to policymakers. We can't get into leaders' heads. We can't absolutely know who has the most influence until that's observable in behavior.
I want to talk about your career. How does somebody become, like, what is the trajectory by which you end up doing North Korea analysis for the CIA?
I'm from New York, and I really wanted to do African-American history. So I went to Columbia to get my PhD because Eric Foner was there, and all the big guys and women who were doing African-American history and civil rights movements and social movements were at Columbia. So I got my PhD there. And then, as I was in my program, I decided I wanted to do foreign relations and gender and race and how that influences and religion and how that influences foreign policy behaviors. But then I decided that I didn't want to do academia anymore. And a friend of mine from who was in my program connected me to somebody at the CIA. We had lunch at Bertucci's in McLean. And he said, you'd be great at this job. Let me hook you up with so-and-so. And, of course, I went through the whole processes that are required for the CIA. It's not like your dad works at J.P. Morgan and you get an internship at J.P. Morgan. But it was, you have to go through the bureaucracy and through the channels. And when I got hired, there was an opening for North Korea. And when the manager hired me, I said, promise me that I will not do North Korea for the rest of my life. 10 years later, here I am sitting here with you talking about North Korea at Brookings, hired for my North Korea expertise.
All right, so let's talk about that. I mean, how much, the president famously, I think he probably meant to be praising the analyst he was talking to or about, referred to, famously or infamously referred to a CIA briefer on North Korea. Why isn't this pretty Korean lady representing us to the North Koreans? How much of the team that does this kind of analytical work is Korean background? Is that a language thing? Is it an interest thing? Or is it actually a pretty diverse crew that does DPRK analysis?
So I think I forgot about that story, Ben. But
I wish I could.
Yeah. When that story broke and... It was a Pakistan analyst who was briefing President Trump in the Oval, and so my first reaction was, of course, who do I know who is a Pakistan analyst and is a PDB briefer or is a substantive expert who's going to brief the president? So that was my first reaction, going through my Rolodex, and the next thing I know, I see people on the street and my colleagues and my friends said, I didn't know you used to cover Pakistan. I think that, we're not going to go into how many people work there, what types of people, but I think certainly the Korean language and knowing the culture helps, but you don't necessarily have to be of Korean heritage. I think we have to rely on diversity in intelligence analysis and any kind of analysis. From my perspective, we had geographic diversity. We had people from IR backgrounds or history backgrounds or English backgrounds or linguistics, for example. But I think that's something that's required to have a fuller picture of North Korea and other hard targets and any target for that matter.
I had actually forgotten that it was a Pakistan analyst that he'd said that about. Thanks for reminding me. So I'm interested in if we control for ego and we control for sort of hyper-enthusiasm following a moment like Singapore. What is a reasonable set of expectations that the U.S. government could have at this stage regarding the current engagement with the DPRK?
We've hit a roadblock, stalemate, whatever you want to call it. I think, the President Trump has done what no other president, U.S. president, has done before, which is to meet with Kim Jong-un. So I get it. It's leader to leader. Kim is the only one who makes the nuclear decisions. You could argue that it was the right move. But Trump didn't prepare. He boasted about not preparing for Singapore. He told his negotiators and the North Koreans...
I didn't prepare for this interview, by the way. I just want everybody... Like, I just feel really confident about my ability to have a conversation with Jung just on the basis of my personality.
It's working. So President Trump said, I don't even need to prepare. And he said this in other occasions where it's the sheer force of his personality and his skills that he can get people to cave or compromise. The Singapore summit was the by all standards, I wasn't expecting very much to begin with, but it was by far the worst thing I had seen on North Korea in looking at it. 13 years prior to the Singapore summit, the North Koreans in 2005 said they would completely abandon all existing nuclear weapons programs. In the Singapore summit, Kim agreed to work toward the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, which is not just watered down, it's completely diluted to the point that that you could fill it a baby bath with it. So I think it was worth trying a leader-to-leader summit, but it required a lot of thinking and preparation. The North Koreans have been preparing for this type of moment for decades. We're on a trajectory where Kim is relying on his attempts to decouple Trump from the rest of his advisors and the national security establishment.
So if John Bolton were here, it's a big if, but if he were here, I suspect he would say, hang on a second. You know, at the time that President Trump took office, the North Koreans were testing missiles on a regular basis. We were all afraid of escalation between them and us, between them and the South Koreans. And now they are not testing missiles. We've given up nothing in order to bring that about, except a certain theatrics. And so we've actually de-escalated a situation by escalating it and have achieved something maybe temporary, but not insubstantial. And my question is, if John Bolton were here and he said that, would he be wrong?
There's something to be said for the fact that there are no more ballistic missile tests or nuclear tests. I'll take it. I'll also take that the North Koreans have offered inspections or observers to look at their allegedly dismantled nuclear test site and a missile engine test site. But as we started out this podcast, we talked about the New York Times article on these missile bases that the North Koreans are continuing to operate. So I think we have to separate what's overt and what's covert. And does President Trump care about the covert? The question really is, has the threat been reduced? Kim Jong-un said that he was going to mass-produce nuclear weapons. He's continuing to develop them and produce fissile material for nuclear weapons. He still has these capabilities. Those ICBMs didn't just disappear because the summit started. He still has those capabilities. So my question for Mr. Bolton, if he were sitting here, is what lessons do you think Kim is learning from all of this? That optics matter more than the substance? And also, what are the costs of looking at just the WMD program? What's the value that we place on not talking about the North Korean human rights issue? What's the value of not talking about the chemical and biological weapons that Kim used to kill his half-brother in Malaysia? What is the value of not talking about the fact that they have overseas, that they use slave labor? So I think, let's think about it in those terms of have we reduced the North Korean threat?
I want you to answer some of those questions that you just posed. I mean, if you look at the last 2 years, it's coming up on 2 years, and you ask the question, control for the crazy theatrics, control for all the weird optics, and just say, in what ways are we in a better position today, and in what ways are we in a worse position today than we were when the president took office? How do you assess it?
I'm really glad that we're not in the fire and fury of last year. And what Kim and the region has done is set up these guardrails to make sure that we don't return to fire and fury. And Kim is doing that by meeting with the Chinese president, meeting with the South Korean president multiple times, talking about going to see Putin in Russia or vice versa. So I think so what Kim and the others in the region have been trying to do is to make sure that we don't return to the very tense atmosphere where there was real fear of a military conflict. So yes, I'm glad that we're not at that in that stage of where we were last year. But Kim has done a lot in the past year to help us to forget that he has these capabilities, that in having the summits and having the U.S. president not talk about the other issues of human rights and the way he treats his people, that we are giving Kim more credit than necessary or even helpful.
I want to throw you a curveball and ask you about North Korea humor. This is a subject that's bothered me for a lot of years, and I don't, sort of Nazi Germany humor is kind of off limits. People don't do it. There's not a lot of gulag humor. And for some reason, there is a license. There's not a lot of Great Leap Forward humor out there. And for some reason, there is a license in a lot of circles to treat North Korea as faintly amusing. And I have always found it peculiar and deeply offensive, and I don't understand why it is understood to be okay. And I'm interested just in your thoughts on, like, why is it okay that there's this website that lots of people look at called Kim Jong-un Looking at Things, which has, which no one would make a Hitler Looking at Things website. Why is there something that it's okay to find amusing about the sort of clownish nature of the regime rather than talking about the sort of awesome brutality of it, and that there is really been nothing like it in a great many decades anywhere in the world?
I've been thinking about that a lot too. We had the movie Interview from 2014. We had Team America. So anytime you mention North Korea, somebody inevitably mentions those two movies. On the one hand, North Korea just invites that kind of humor. Here is Kim Jong-un looking at a lubrication factory, right? Here is Kim Jong-un looking at turtles. Here's Kim Jong-un waving to people at the amusement park. And so in being so odd and so clearly odd and so outside the and outside of the international community on so many different levels, that it's easy to make fun of North Korea. And there's a convergence of, of Orientalism, of downplaying North Korea because it's an Asian, small Asian country, and that it brings out the worst in that kind of prejudicial or, in these racist narratives. But it's also something that Kim believes in. There is a racial purity thing that Kim and the regime has tried to convey, that they're the true North Korea because their blood is untainted. Women and defectors in North Korea who are caught in China and are taken back to North Korea, if they're pregnant with a suspected Chinese man's baby, they're beaten until they're forcibly aborted. And so there is a sense of keeping the blood in North Korea pure. So that said, the cheap North Korea humor, I think it undermines or underplays the threat that it poses, and it serves as a reminder about our racial and other biases, racial and gender biases, on looking at this issue, and also how that also skews our policy discussions about how to deal with North Korea. President Trump has talked about how Kim's a great guy. He believes in, he's doing great for 27-year-old, for somebody who took over the family business when he was 27. And I think that downplays the threat that Kim poses. Here's a guy with ICBMs, nuclear weapons, and a whole host of other things that threaten our security and his people's security.
I also I mean, I do think that there's a element of the North Korea humor that is a reflection of our own discomfort with our inability to do anything about it. And that, you know, we, during World War II, you had a war effort that you could direct a lot of that anger to. You had, you know, in a standoff with the Soviet Union, you could arm the, you know, Nicaraguan Contras or the, you know, the Afghan Mujahideen, right? But in, but with North Korea, there is this collective sense of helplessness. And so I think there's an element of it that we just choose to giggle about the clownishness of the regime rather than face the fact that what we've actually done is built a wall around it and or allowed it to build a wall around itself, and anything inside is its business and will protect outside, and, you know, may God have mercy on our souls.
I think the dangerous part is that what the North Korean, the caricatures of North Korea, what that reminds me of is how in World War II, the caricatures of the Japanese that were not, that you didn't find a similar caricature of Germans, whether they're buck-toothed or smaller or just these automatons who just who are less human than maybe the Germans. And what that does is enable somebody like Senator Graham to say it's better to have deaths over there, right? Instead of risking the U.S., the continental United States.
All right. So let us open this up for questions.
Stanley Kober, not so much a question as a comment. The New York Times story to which you referred was immediately challenged by 38 North, a think tank now based at Stimson, used to be at the U.S.-Korea Institute at Zeiss. And they thought it wasn't a very accurate account, I think it's fair to say. So they did challenge it.
So fair point. I mean, in your judgment, is the underlying report accurate? And is the New York Times' characterization, no, I'm asking Jung, is your sense of the report as something with integrity? And is the New York Times' account of it reasonable?
The CSIS report is fine. It didn't make any big judgments about what this was or about what the diplomacy was all about. But I think the bottom line was that the Times article suggested it was a North Korea deception. And the Twitterverse and others have pointed out that North Korea didn't promise anything on its missile bases. So it's newsworthy, but not that newsworthy. But it's a reminder that we need to keep an eye out.
I wanted to go back to North Korean humor for a moment and wondered if you could talk about Putin as a counterpoint in American culture, because there are moments where Putin is characterized as sort of buffoon or the shirtless pictures on the horse. So is there anything that we can track in the way that he is characterized as opposed to the way North Korea is characterized?
I would just add to that the pictures of Putin on a horse are produced by Russian propagandists, but the question's a fair one. Is there a relationship or is there a disparity between the way we treat scary Russians and scary North Koreans?
Correct me if I'm wrong, Ben and others. Putin is almost always portrayed as an uber masculine leader. Kim is, I'd say, a good chunk of the time is portrayed as feminine or weak or soft. And so beyond the pale of what is acceptable for what a man should be. He wears these nondescript Mao jackets. His pants are too flowy. His haircut is too weird. I take your point, but I think that there is an element of a gendered bias, and when we look at Kim,
at this point, given how invested South Korean leadership is in furthering the peace process with North Korea, building railroads, developing ties, What do you think it would take to change their calculus? And I'm fully aware that you kicked off this by saying that it's very hard to interpret leadership intentions, so I apologize for that. But it's really, that was a very crucial aspect to changing North Korean behavior, bringing them to the table. And if South Korea isn't on board with U.S. actions, where does that leave us?
If anybody was scared shitless by the... Am I allowed to say that?
Oh, yes.
If anybody was scared shitless about the fire and fury, it was more of the South Korean government than it was the North Korean government. Remember, they were trying to plan for the Olympics. They could not sell tickets for the South Korean Olympics. And one of the reasons for... A part of the reasons for the President Moon's outreach to North Korea and trying to get North Korea to participate in the Olympics is so that they don't kill people for the Olympics, and so that they can create this mood of peace so that people will buy tickets for the Pyeongchang Olympics that started in February 2018. The Moon administration has talked about how they want to have denuclearization and peace on the peninsula, or inter-Korean peace, operate and move forward on the same track. But what's been clear is that the track that the train of North Korea and U.S. relations have stalled while President Moon and Chairman Kim have been talking more about inter-Korean peace and economic cooperation at a faster speed and pace than the denuclearization side. So I think that's where the gap is. Where are we going to prioritize whether the South Korean government is going to continue forward without attendant progress on denuclearization?
Hi, I actually had a question kind of about refugees resettling from North Korea to South Korea. Given that there's a little bit of a job crisis going on for especially younger generations in South Korea who feel like the government let them down in terms of promising jobs, but there's also refugees who are trying to resettle in other Asian countries from North Korea, including resettling in South Korea. How can the South Korean government, or really any other entity, show that this is a worthy cause and show that, you know, accepting refugees, especially younger refugees, isn't going to create more of an economic crisis or make South Koreans feel more vulnerable than they already feel?
You know, I have to say that the defector community and the you're talking about refugees, not North Korean. Is that what you're asking about?
North Korean
defectors. From what I see, the South Korean population is very much against the refugee resettlement for people from the Middle East. On the North Korean defectors, there is no constituency to advocate on behalf of North Korean defectors because of that labor issue and the fact that there's a perception that absorbing too many cheap labor, right, is going to lead to reduced opportunities for other people. And that's something that South Korea has to deal with. And so far, what's been really disappointing from my perspective is that we have that the Moon administration to continue to nurture this mood of diplomacy with Kim has put a kibosh on NGO activities, defector activities, defectors speaking out against the regime, and defunding a lot of the human rights organizations in South Korea. So at this point, that's a political decision to do that. But I think it would be useful if South Korea can show that they're able to take care of its people, but also the people who are willing to who are fleeing severe economic and other deprivation from North Korea.
Evening, thanks for having us. I wanted to ask about the video that was presented to Kim in anticipation of the Singapore summit. Whether you thought it was well-tailored or just another exhibit of the tone deafness of Trump foreign policy.
That video was about, if I remember correctly, it was horses galloping through the beach. It was condominiums and lots of lights and restaurants and fancy cars and all this type of consumer goods that we can offer, right? And Secretary of State Pompeo has said, if only North Korea will change its, you know, its perspective, we can send American entrepreneurs and all these companies and all this wealth to North Korea, and it's going to be fantastic. There's no doubt that Kim has all the money that he needs and he wants. At one point, there were some estimated 100 villas that the Kim family had dotting the entire landscape. So they're not hurting for money or for luxury goods or cognac or Cuban cigars or Louis Vuitton bags. And so when you know when that video was shown, which I think it was probably a South Korean developed film, that it was tone deaf and that you're promising Kim this this thing that he can have already and that he has already, but then you add the threat of having American entrepreneurs and tourists and other people running around North Korea infecting people with crazy ideas about democracy and liberal capitalism. And so I don't think that works. It's a vision as much as it is a threat.
Okay. This is Jenny Oberholzer. I'm interested. I'm coming at this from kind of a weird Eastern European focus perspective. So I think about the collapse of East Germany a lot and reunification. And I also think about the collapse of other governments. So my question for you is, in an ideal world, assuming that aliens abduct people who want dictatorship to continue and there's a massive power vacuum or not, how could things end really well and how could things end really badly? For people, just what's the span there?
How things could end really badly, I think people could envision that last year when we're talking about nuclear, the potential for nuclear war. And so, you know, but first of all, I have to say that, you know, what I found useful at the agency was to talk, you know, talk with the people with different perspectives, you know, the people who worked on Germany or Eastern European countries. And that provides fresh perspective on how you look at North Korea and other types of things. So in the event of a power vacuum, what's likely to happen is that another member of Kim's family is going to be at least a figurehead for some time. And that's what the regime has been cultivating, pruning the rest of the family tree to make sure that the only ones who have the power, who have safe power, are the people who share a mother and a father with Kim Jong-un.
So assume Donald Trump isn't president and we have a fully staffed State Department. What does a rational U.S. policy towards North Korea actually look like? Is it some version of maximum pressure all over again, or is it accepting North Korea as a nuclear-armed state?
So that is a fabulous question on which to end, and we're going to make it the last one. Jung, what are your thoughts?
Yes. My preference would be that we have a holistic look at North Korea. Kim is not just developing his ICBMs and his fissile materials. He's developing a lot of things. He has chemical biological weapons. He has short range and close range ballistic missiles and intermediate range ballistic missiles. There are human rights violations that undergird the nuclear weapons program. So what I would like to see with the new administration or even within this administration is a holistic look at how to apply pressure points at multiple levels and to make sure that our allies are on board with everything that we do.
Jung Pak, thanks so much for joining us. Please.
Thank you so much. This is really fun.
All right, so I'm going to chat with Maggie a little bit because there are all these people who aren't in the room who don't actually know anything about the NatSec Girl Squad. So first of all, Maggie, why don't you introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi, I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilch, and I am the founder of NatSec Girl Squad.
All right.
Oh, thanks, guys.
All right, so... most people who are listening to this, if they know NatSec Girl Squad at all, they know it as a hashtag. What is it?
So you're not wrong. It is a hashtag. And that hashtag, without the pound symbol, thank God, is in fact tattooed on my rib cage. So that is a big part of it. But NatSec Girl Squad is a membership organization for people, notice I said people and not a specific gender, people who are committed to competent diversity throughout the national security apparatus, though we do focus on defense and national security. Was that an answer?
It was.
Okay.
And why are we gathered this evening doing a happy hour with a whole bunch of people associated with NatSec Girl Squad.
So today was our very first all-day, what I'm calling a policy symposium, a.k.a. somewhat standard D.C. event, but it was all day. And when I say all day, I mean we had breakfast, lunch, and an afternoon snack, followed by this dinner opportunity. So we've all been together now for about 12 hours. And we spent the day, instead of kind of describing standard national security type topics that come up at most think tanks, we spent the day talking about areas that we felt like as a group were overlooked and focusing on airing out policy solutions to them. And it was fun.
And what are the, I mean, so you described, when you described the NatSec Girl Squad before, you described it as a group committed to diversity across the apparatus. What is it, I mean, and today you had your first conference. What does the organization do at a sort of practical level?
Sure. So we focus on three things. We focus on building networks among mostly women and allies who are committed to this shared idea, right? Building expertise among those women, and then building their own confidence in that expertise. So there are a lot of groups that do a lot of incredible work in this space, and this is where we decided to focus.
All right. So for listeners of this podcast who are kind of involved in the field, what should they be doing that would be helpful to people associated with this organization? And secondly, to people who might be listening to this and might want to be involved in this organization at the, boy, that sounds like that could be an organization that could help me with stuff that I'm thinking about and working on and trying to achieve. How do people get involved?
Sure. So I'm going to answer the second question first because it's the cooler question anyways. So like I said, we're a membership organization. And so you can join and be a member. And what that means when you're a member, we do about 4 to 5 events each month. And they are open both to members and non-members. However, our goal is that always after you purchase your membership, that it pays for itself within 30 days. You also get access to a listserv that is like 12,000 people around the world that share jobs and internships and fellowships. But really the first step is becoming a member. So you go online to natsecgirlsquad.com, and there's a very clear button that says membership, and it lists out all our different levels of membership. They start out at $20 a year for students. There's even a special category of men of NatSec Girl Squad. So, and you can pick your denomination for that, which is very nice. But that's really the first step. We also want people to interact with us online. We recognize that the foreign policy blob, right, exists a lot on Twitter these days. And whether we like it or not, it's just reality. I know that my dad feels pretty negatively about it, but that's fine. So follow us on Twitter and use the hashtag. The reason that NatSec Girl Squad is called what it is with the hashtag as the name is that it is ideally searchable across any platform. So whether you're on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, I don't use Snapchat, but maybe someone's using it on there, you can find job postings, you can find events, and you can find other people who support what you're doing and want to be a part of it. And our mission statement is on our website, but ultimately what we ask of our members is define success for yourself and decide how you want us to support you, and that's what we're going to do. And our rule of thumb is you can do whatever you want in the name of NatSec Girl Squad as long as you are not an asshole.
Maggie Feldman-Pilch, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
All right, guys, the Lawfare podcast is now, as ever, produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. When we do live podcasts, we don't have music, but if we did have music, it would be performed by Sophia Yan. There are a lot of people out there who have not yet been brought into the light, don't know about the Lawfare podcast, because like the NatSec Girl Squad, we are advertised entirely by word of mouth. So if you're sitting in this room, and I want you to pick up your phone, actually, and tweet about the Lawfare podcast. Share the Lawfare podcast on Facebook. And if you're listening at home, I want you to pretend you were sitting in this room and that you then picked up the phone and tweeted or shared on Facebook. Or if you're at a dinner party, just talk annoyingly about it. Oh, don't forget that rating on iTunes, on Stitcher, or whatever podcast distribution service you use. And as always, thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.